Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Morelia Python Radio. We are back, brought to you. Yes. It seems like forever.
Be back. Jesus Christ. It's only 2 weeks, but God.
That was a really a long 2 weeks, man. It felt like.
Yeah, enough of this crap. I mean, you and I did that. You and I did that. That dry run yesterday, and I went through my phone, and I'm like, holy crap, I like haven't called the number to call in 2 weeks, therefore it's no longer in my recent calls. Like, I'm like taken aback for a moment.
Like,
crap. Yeah, I didn't know what to do. I was totally flustered.
Well, no worries. I did you solid, Owen. We go back to our roots, back to the early days of Morelia Python Radio when Owen was all about coastal carpet python. So I brought on one of the guests that would know coastal carpet pythons from the field. That's right. All the way from Australia. We're going to be talking with Nathan Garrett from Chimera Productions. Basically what Nathan does is if you have a lace monitor in your tree in your backyard, he goes and gets it. If you have a coastal carpet on the roof of your shed, he goes and picks it up and relocates.
The man is living our dream, damn it.
Yeah.
So, yes. I want to get paid for that shit.
No kidding. So he's going to be talking about coastal carpets, what he sees and his thoughts. And, you know, I thought, you know, we talk about breeding carpets and all this kind of stuff. And wouldn't it be cool to talk to somebody right from Australia that has carpet pythons in their backyard? I mean, that's just crazy to me. I mean, it's just nuts. So we're looking forward
and,
to
it. And knows them from a wild-like aspect. So it's not just he has them as he's not just, you know, keeping them and breeding them in Australia. He deals with the wild aspect of these animals in his everyday life. So that's what is going to be really cool to me. And we have some questions to try to kind of figure out the inner workings, because we're always trying to improve the lives of our captive, born and bred and captive animals by studying their wild cousins. So this is, who knows, he might give us a little trick, a little flip. He might have seen carpets out at this temperature that might be some key to keeping them healthier, happier, and longer in captivity.
Heck yeah, yeah. So it's been, we're going to be getting into that in a couple minutes, and we have the dates for the Carpet Fest, East Coast and West Coast. So in a minute here, we'll get Howard on and talk to him about it. Howard Redding from Redding Reptile Breeders. He's the host of the
Carpet Fest with the most
of the Northeast chapter.
Yeah,
which would be the best chapter.
You can't make that statement. You can't do that. You're going to get people pissed off. But
yeah, that's true. I have to tell you
along. It's we're starting 2014 off with a call from Howard and a call from somebody down in Australia. I mean,
Christ. I mean, this is kind of cool. So
this is a damn good show.
Yeah, and Howard, he's a Coastal Carpet Python nut too, so he'll probably love this show.
He is.
Yeah. So, and you know, I just want to we're gonna talk for a minute about the reptile report award, and get this out of the way. I kind of posted up. I know people were kind of bummed and kind of upset that we didn't win, you know, first I want to thank everybody. We want to thank everybody for going out and taking the time to vote and, you know, give us some accolades for what we do. You know, this isn't easy, what we do. And I ain't going to lie, it was nice to have 2 weeks off.
Yeah,
you know,
it was really nice to get that. And, you know, a killer shout out to everybody who got out there and voted. I mean, we love you guys, and thank you so much for even – the fact that we got more than 2 votes from, like, you and I is amazing. So, you know, the fact that, like, you know, you and I voted for each other and then other people, like, did is, fantastic. And even the fact that we were nominated for going through to this, and even – and you got to think, we got to the nomination round, and then we went to the top 10 round, which is the voting round. The fact that we even got there, in my opinion – is incredible and noteworthy for all you guys out there who listen to us and enjoy us. So thank you.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. People are upset. I understand why people are upset. I mean, like I said in the post, I would admit if we were a little bummed.
Yeah.
We would have loved it. You know, it would have been great.
Yeah.
But I don't want to win by cheating. I don't want to win because we don't like somebody else. I don't want to win for any other reason than the fact that you think what we do is good and you dig what we do, you know. That's what I'm about. I'm about being, you know, above board and straight and all that kind of stuff. Apparently, there was some fraudulent votes, and with said fraudulent votes, we didn't win. And that's just that. So I would urge people – you know, don't be upset. It's, you know, it's just what it is, what it is. I mean, you know, to be in a community that's as niche, like a niche market as we are, and to be out there in the forefront with, you know, people that have ranges of topics and covered all different types of reptile keeping and such, that to me is a huge accomplishment. And, you know, that goes out to the fans, but don't make us look like sore losers or, you know, I don't know. I just, I don't like.
Let's not stoop down to a level that we don't want to be. I mean,
we're
bummed that we lost, but there's no, you know, this is not a reflection on how this competition went. It's not a reflection on, the Reptile Report, anybody running that, ship your reptiles. None of that had anything to do with this. So, you know, don't run around screaming about boycotting and banning. And it is what it is. We lost. It doesn't mean that Morelia Python Radio is going to go off the air. It doesn't mean that anything is going to change. It just means that you can pour me a taller drink at Carpet Fest to try to soothe the sorrows of it. I will take said drink and drink it, and that's it. That's all. You know, we have nothing but love and respect for everybody else in this community, despite what sometimes I may say. So let's just again enjoy the fact that we were there to stand toe to toe with everybody else. There were some really hard hitting names out there, not just in our category. So, you know, it just take solace in that, and we'll move forward. Start planning Carpet Fest.
That's right. So without
torches and pitchforks down. Put them down.
Yeah.
No more.
Let's get,
yeah.
Let's get Howard Redding on here, and let's talk about Carpet Fest real quick. Howard Redding, what's up?
Yeah, hey, how are you guys doing this evening?
We're
doing
excited,
all right,
man.
Brother. How are you doing? Good. I really don't need know where to start. I guess I should start off by wishing everybody a Happy New Year.
Yes.
Happy
and,
New Year to you too.
Good place to start.
Yeah. we can start this year off to make the whole Morelia everything better.
Yes.
Heck yeah.
As far as, you know, just to be nominated and just that it was this close with the radio show of the year with the Reptile Report, I don't think there needs to be any malice. I just think that we need to have that presence.
Yeah.
You know, that there's that many people supporting us, whether it was bogus or whether, you know, people were, you know, savvy enough to, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Just as long as we're out there and that there is a big enough stink about this that it's noticeable.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, well, regardless of whether there was votes that were cheated or not cheated or whatever, we still came in second. You know what I mean? So even with the votes they took out, we still came in second. And like I said, to be in a position with, you know, you hear us complain all the time about the ball python market and everything like that. I mean, we're running with the big dogs, and you know, to me, that's a pretty good accomplishment. You know,
I think it's, you know, up to us, you know, and a somewhat different market, you know, marketing a different product. I think it's up to us to step it up a little bit and say, okay, well, this is the way it happened, and that's what happened, and that's okay. It stinks. However, hold yourself to a higher standard, and you don't have to run out and, you know, lynch anybody or, you know, start up the pitchforks and the torches and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Just, okay, well, then that's the way it happened, and how can we, you know, just continue on as a community?
Uh-huh.
You know, it's an honor to be in this position. However, it's not what makes us.
Yeah.
Correct.
You know, this isn't what we're about. This was just one little thing. You know, we didn't win the Grammy. Okay, well, maybe next year.
We still made a record, though. You know what I mean?
Yeah, goddamn it. Exactly.
I might be in trouble for running my mouth, though. Because apparently I said that if we won, I would maternally incubate. Apparently I said that if we won, I would maternally incubate a clutch. And apparently Mo is holding me to it. And she's saying I still have to. So.
There you go.
Oh, we won? No, we totally won.
We won.
Oh, shit. All right, well.
My or not. We totally won.
So, yeah, I mean, guess what we were going to even just to close out that and move on to Carpet Fest, I just want to say that, you know, guys, you know, Robin and Chad, those guys, you know, I respect them for what they've done for the reptile community with Chip Your Reptiles, the Reptile Report.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've had Robin on the show. We've talked to him, and, you know, they've done great things for the community, and it just seems silly. You know, again, people were using how I say vote with the dollar. And I do say vote with the dollar. If you don't approve of something or you don't like what they do, then by all means, I mean, they're business people and they're running a business. And if you complain about something because you feel that how they're handling themselves are not correct, then talk to them personally, give them a chance to change it or explain it or whatever, you know, before you go and do it publicly. And, you know, I'm just saying that has nothing to do with us losing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It seems like the two are kind of like mixing together, and I want to keep it separate. So that's a whole other issue that's not even worth our airtime. But you know what is worth our airtime? Carpet Fest. What say you?
Carpet Fest. Damn it.
Carpet Fest.
Okay, I'll lay it on you, folks. All right, the Northeast Carpet Fest will be held once again here in my domicile. May 17th.
Yes.
And I have not replaced my carpet, as in flooring, because someone might end up bleeding on it again.
you bled on it.
Hopefully. Well, it's my carpet. I can bleed on it if I want.
No, it's all right. Valley point.
That and I'm broke. But besides that, and also the Northwest Carpet Fest.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you that like to listen and go check it out, they have a bunch of stuff going on, and myself, I will even be going out there this year.
Holy crap.
I got to show them how to do it.
Yeah, we're going to piss off the whole West Coast now. All right, let's go for it.
That's okay. I'm headed out there next week just to line things up. But anyway,
there you go.
Owen, you mentioned the best carpet fest is the Northeast Carpet Fest.
Don't you me under that bus?
No, you did mention that because I wrote a note of it so I can remember this stuff. Anyway, I personally have a conflict of interest. However, I will be out there, and maybe some others from the right side will get on out there. But the Northwest Carpet Fest is July 26th.
Yeah, I'm really going to try to swing that one. I'm going to try, even if it's for the weekend. I think that would be cool to hang out with the.
Yeah.
I got to get that cardboard cutout company where you got yours so that Eric can bring me with him as a cardboard cutout and just kind of bring me around the West Carpet Fest.
No, you don't want to do that. That costs a lot. It's cheaper to fly out there and miss to buy one of those damn things. Trust me.
Nice. All right, well, there we go then.
But, yeah, the Northeast Carpet Fest here in Waldorf, same place, same time, May 17th, 3 p.m.
Yep.
If anybody has any questions, you can contact myself at Howard@ReadingReptileBreeders.com or Owen or Eric. They'll shoot you, give you all the information you need. Northwest Carpet Fest, you can contact me. And I'll get you in the right direction.
Very good. We almost have the site finished, carpetfest.com, so you can kind of get pointed in the directions from there. And should be good. This year we're gonna do it up. Probably go over to the Facebook page, Northeast Carpet Fest and Northwest Carpet Fest group pages. And you can probably see the updates. I think it's Northwest, right? Isn't it Northwest Carpet Fest? Is that how it's worded?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's what they're trying to do.
Right.
But
so look for there for updates.
The Sea Chickens are also trying to beat the Saints next weekend, which isn't going to happen. Sorry, I had to throw that in there. I got so many friends out there in Seattle.
There you go.
It
won't happen.
Nope.
We shall see. So yeah, I mean, Carpet Fest is a good time, and we're going to try to do it bigger and better, and keep growing it, and trying to make sure that it's a good time for all, and it's just about hanging out with your fellow Morelia python keeper breeder people, and the Morelia family, and it's a cool group of people, and we keep cool snakes, and we get to know each other on a personal personal level and make connections and new friendships and
yep.
You know, it's
and then
a
there's
good
the
time,
auction
so.
And the drinking. Do it.
Oh yeah.
Come.
That too.
Damn it. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It really is. And you know, that's part of it. And this year the auctions, if correct me if I'm wrong, Eric, the auctions are 50% of it are going to RICO and the other 50 are going to USARC. Am I
yep.
incorrect by that statement?
No, that's correct.
I think you're right.
Yep.
Okay. Okay. It's happened once before. I was so, right once. Yeah.
Right. So yeah, cool.
Well, I don't want to hold up Nathan, and I always follow all his posts and everything that he puts up and his incredible pictures that us here in the States just scream about and let ourselves. And I want to hear about his adventures. So whatever
heck
you guys
yeah.
have to say, I'm going to step off here and thank you very much for promoting that. And actually, I would like to promote something else if you don't mind.
Yeah, go
for
it.
Okay, there's a group of us that started a new page. And just to get Morelia people more into the market, and it's called Carpet Row. You can find it on Facebook. It's all the usual faces at Tinley. Kind of it is a internet presence of that.
Right.
So you can come there and you can go to the Carpet Row page and see what we have brewing and what our future pairings are and what we have for sale.
Cool.
Nice.
And it's, great idea.
It's a quality. It wasn't mine, so obviously it's great. So it's no, it's please, folks, check it out. And, come, you know, see if you're interested in carpet pythons. You know, we might have what you need. And if us in Carpet Row do not, then we can certainly, you know, direct you to the right position to facilitate it.
Cool. Good stuff, man.
Yep. All right, folks, go ahead and take off the show. Nathan, thank you very much. And Eric and Owen, as always, it's a pleasure.
Later, man.
All right.
Okay. All right.
Enjoy your evening. Go Saints.
Thanks, Howard. There we go. Okay. All right, Owen. I don't know about you, but, there's a lot of things that have happened between now and then, but let's stop rambling and let's get Nathan on here and let's get this going.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Nathan, how you doing? Welcome to Morelia Python Radio.
Yeah, g'day, Owen. G'day, Eric. How is everybody this evening?
That's fantastic.
Great.
I love the greeting. The fact that we went that way is amazing. right off the bat, Australian. Love it. Fantastic. We're doing all right. So... thanks for calling us all the way from, you know, down
yeah,
around the globe.
Yeah, no, well, look, I appreciate having me on, so thank you. Thank you to both of you, and thank you to Howard for the shout-out as well. I really appreciate that.
Awesome. So, now, Nathan, normally what we do is we kind of just jump right into it with, we want to know how you got your start into reptiles.
Well, my father actually kept reptiles before me at a young age, and I basically grew up with reptiles in the family home, so I kind of like to think that it's in my blood as a second-generation herper, not just somebody who's fallen into the passion of reptiles. I mean, as a small boy, I loved dinosaurs, and it sort of grew into the real dinosaurs of today's world, which is reptiles. So for as long as I can remember, at about age 4, we had our first children's python. At about age 12 or 13 was when I started keeping quite seriously. Basically all the common reptiles that I could catch and keep myself. And it sort of grew and blossomed from there.
Awesome. Awesome. So like when you were a kid, how many snakes did you have?
Not many. It was mainly lizards. The snakes were a little bit harder to catch. So, and with Australia having more venomous snakes than harmless ones, it kind of wasn't a thing for a teenage boy to have a house full of brown snakes and taipans and things like that. So it was mainly a lot of small lizards and blue tongues, bearded dragons, things like that. But I eventually chose a career in aquaculture. Which was quite a big interest of mine, and fish is still a big interest of mine. And then throughout high school, I stopped keeping for a little while until I was in a position to begin keeping. And I still actually have one of my first pythons that I ever got when I began keeping again at the end of high school. So,
what python's that?
It's a Queensland water python.
Ah, I love those. my water python's a jerk.
mine is the epitome of jerk water pythons. He's his name's Brody, and many people have probably seen the photos of him with his standing up in an S position with his mouth open, mm-hmm. ready to tear somebody's face off. And look, I love him to death. I wouldn't have him any other way. He's been like that since day one.
Fantastic. So, tell us tell us about your business, Chimera Productions. What is it you do with Chimera Productions?
Yeah, look, it actually just started as a hobby. It got to the point where after a few years of doing a few snake removals for friends and family and members of the public in my spare time, I was actually getting called away from work. To actually perform snake removals for local councils, the police, concerned members of the public and things like that. So it sort of grew from something that I used to just enjoy in spare time to a full time, which, I mean, is probably the best way to grow a business. Instead of jumping in at the deep end, you get a feel for the market and make sure that it's going to be viable, and mm-hmm. we continue to grow bigger and bigger every year.
That's fantastic. So, what species do you normally deal with?
Look, probably the main two species that I relocate are coastal carpet pythons and the which is they're in the top five most venomous snakes in the world. So, I don't want to risk my life on a daily basis. Look, I make the job look easy occasionally, but. it's the sort of thing that I'd rather myself do it than some stupid idiot try and kill it, or some cowboy that saw it on TV once try and do the same sort of thing. So, and then I deal with animals from blue tongues to red belly black snakes. The list of species is quite extensive. Pretty much every snake species that I get in my local area, I've encountered at least once in a removal job or something like that.
Awesome. So can you take us through a day in the life of a snake catcher? I mean, what do you do? Do you just kind of hang around and wait for the phone to ring off your desk about something? Or
it's pretty much about it. I tell people that when I'm not out catching snakes, I'm sitting at home scratching myself waiting for the phone to ring. But look, with it... With a big reptile collection, there's always work to be done. I've always got snake crap to pick up. I've always got snakes to feed. I breed my own rodents for my captive collection as well. So that's almost a full-time job in itself. And then I think, as most reptile people, we probably spend too much time on the internet, Facebook forums and things like that. So, yes, I'm guilty of sitting around on Facebook posting photos and stirring trouble and all of the fun stuff that goes with the internet whilst I wait for the phone to ring.
And sounds then, like a plan.
yeah. Look, I mean, it's better than doing the 9-to-5 grind of working for the man type thing and making somebody else money. I mean, I'm not going to be a millionaire doing what I do, but I'm doing what I love. So
awesome. So now, how is the public's overall response to, you know, snakes in their backyard? I got called to a firehouse once because everybody around them was swearing up and down that they had a copperhead, when turns out it was a harmless water snake that they had, you know, corralled into this trash can and duct taped into the trash can and threw sandbags on top of the trash can. I mean, is the response a little bit better? Are they better at identifying things? Do you know what you're walking into?
No, I've jotted little notes down for the questions there. I really think that there's a stupidity epidemic worldwide as far as the ignorance towards reptiles go. I basically have had the same thing. People seeing these tiny little harmless animals and they're fearing for their lives that it's the biggest, baddest, meanest, most dangerous snake that they've ever seen. And I get there and find something the size of a pencil that is not even regarded dangerous to a cat or a dog, let alone a fully grown man or anything like that. And then there's the opposite end of the scale. I get there and find an animal chopped into pieces with a shovel or bullet holes riddled through it and everything like that. So, look, there's probably the same as in America. There is that mentality some people do appreciate all forms of animal and give them the respect that they deserve, and I commend people for that. But at the same time, I really wish I could go around smacking people on the head with shovels sometimes, but it's, obviously in a business sense, that's not going to really work well for me.
No, they probably won't call you back if you smack them with a shovel when you arrive. I mean,
no.
That's just a given. So.
And look, I've learned over the years not to abuse clients. I mean, I've nearly got into physical altercations and punch-ups and things like that when I turn up to a job. After they've called me, I turn up, and because I took 30 seconds too long to arrive, they thought that I wasn't coming, so they've decided to chop the snake up. And I've gotten there and get out of the car, basically abusing them for their stupidity, and one thing leads to another, and pushing and shoving. And look, in the end, people are going to be stupid, whether it's with reptiles or whether it's with just general life. If they want to be stupid, then look, as long as it doesn't hurt me, go and be stupid somewhere else so I don't have to hear about it, basically.
Yeah, that's a shame.
It is. And look, I'm guessing you guys experience it all over the States as well with ignorance, misidentification and all of those sorts of things. But then there's people out there that see a corn snake cruising through the fields and basically go, oh, well, look, it's not going to bother me. I'm not going to bother it and leave it alone. And we get the same thing here as well.
Yeah, there's always the person who kills a rat snake with a garden hoe, or I think the latest one was with a nail gun because it was cruising in their barn and they feared for the lives of their, you know, half-ton horses, and they killed it. And it's like, you do know that was pointless and unnecessary, but, you know, I believe you kind of hit the nail on the head. Stupid people are going to be stupid regardless of how many times you tell them something. So it's just a damn shame that the animals have to suffer for it. And, of course, you know, we have the rattlesnake roundups around here, so it's even more ignorance and stupidity down there than I know what to shake a stick at. But what are some of the strategies that you found to be a good way to educate the public when it comes to reptiles and conservation?
I mean, look, on the job, face-to-face is a really good educational tool. So every phone call that I receive, whether they require the service or just inquiring about the service and what to do if they see a snake, I really hope to get into doing educational shows in the schools in the coming years, because I really think that next generation of adults, if we can reach them in the schools, that's really, really going to help try and sort of educate them about respecting nature in general. I really feel that if somebody's less likely to kill a snake, they're less likely to go and kill a dog. They're probably less likely to go and kill a person, which overall is going to make society a lot more of a warm and fuzzy, happy type place. I regularly try and do interviews with local newspaper and local television stations and things like that. Obviously, the Facebook page, not only do I share my love for reptiles with other herp nuts, but I also try and share with the public as much as possible as well, and do educational posts and videos and things like that. So, I mean, look, in the end, I don't think anyone's ever going to be able to reach the entire population and change their mindset. I think all we can really do is hope the ignorant, stupid ones that they keep it in their pants and don't reproduce, and they sort of basically die out through natural attrition, and then the world's hopefully taken over by kind, caring, forgiving hippies and greenies, really, but not to the extreme. But I mean, it'd be good if everyone just let everything be and got on with their own lives.
Yeah. No, that's, like I said, it's a damn shame that animals keep having to suffer for stupidity, but it's good that you're out there helping the ones you can.
And yeah, as I said, I commend the people that do actually call me, and I'm always extremely grateful for every job that I do get, for the fact that they haven't taken matters into their own hands. They respect that animal's right to life. And I find most people that call me have usually got some form of pet, whether it be a goldfish in a bowl or a dog or a horse or a cat or some chickens. And they sort of see that even though a snake may not be the animal that they love, they still give it the respect as a living creature. And they find that getting it relocated safely and humanely is the best thing for that animal.
Definitely.
All right, so where exactly are you at in Australia, Nathan?
I'm in my snake room.
I mean, you're in Queensland, right?
Yes, southeast Queensland, in a small town or city called Toowoomba. It's about 2 hours west of Brisbane, and about 2 hours sort of north of the New South Wales-Queensland border. The town's actually situated right on the top of the Great Dividing Range, which is a mountain range that runs from basically the tip of Cape York all the way down to Victoria. And it sort of divides the coastal fringe and rainforests and things like that with the Great Western Plains and further out into the deserts and things like that. So we sort of refer ourselves to being at the top of the range up here. But with the business, we service up to 100 kilometres in every direction. So I see myself going to some dry areas and down onto the lowlands of coastal parts of Queensland as well. Not so much particularly close to the beach, but some of the low-lying swampy areas and dry areas, as well as the rocky areas of the range.
Okay. Very cool. So for us, for the people that are not in Australia, you're coming across carpet pythons in the wild, and I'm going to say for the most part you're coming across coastal carpet pythons, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
The only other python that occurs here is the spotted python or maculosa. All other pythons that I encounter here are the coastal carpet python or McJLI.
Okay, so What is the environment like? Like, give us a feel for, like, you know, what's going on. When you come across a carpet python in the wild, a coastal carpet python, what is the environment like?
Look, it varies extremely. From most of the animals I do encounter in suburbia, or in sort of referred to as a rural residential area, so farmland and things like that, which usually verges onto semi-untouched forest, whether that be dry eucalypt forest or open grassland with scattering of trees and things like that, right through to rocky outcrops and also subtropical rainforest with vine thickets and things like that. I mean, really the best way for people to get a feel is to actually check out the page. I try and post photos regularly that I title as Another Day in the Office, and pretty much every photo there, without sort of going into too much detail, there's probably a carpet python in every photo that I post. It's Another Day in the Office, because that is typical habitat for carpet pythons. They're quite a variable species that obviously wouldn't have survived for so long if they weren't so adaptable to different habitats and environments and things like that.
Okay. Now, we often hear a lot, we often say here a lot for people that keep carpet pythons, is that they're very variable in what they look like when they come out as far as color and pattern. What are you coming across in the wild? Are you seeing the same thing?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I would probably argue that compared to other carpet python subspecies throughout Australia and into New Guinea as well, that the coastal carpet python's probably the most extreme in variability. When you look at how large a range they have and the variation that they exhibit, and I mean, you can probably tell from the photos that I'm catching animals that would almost look like they're crossed with a diamond python. Some of them look like they're crossed with jungle pythons. Some of them look like they're straight out of a Jaguar breeder's collection in the States. There's some pretty amazing animals that I come across, and it's just a testament to how adaptable and variable they are. Within that one small population as well. I mean, it's not like I'm covering thousands of kilometres and have an extremely large sample size, but even in the small 100-kilometre radius from Toowoomba, I find a huge variety of animals.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. Can you notice a difference in pattern, color, or behavior from one area to another area with the carpets?
Look, not so much particularly with behavior. I think if it's a coastal carpet python, it's going to behave like any other coastal carpet python. As far as coloration and markings and things like that, I do tend to notice that it's quite habitat specific. It was something that was told to me many years ago by an old time herper, that dry area carpets with a lot of sunlight and things like that tend to be of a lighter coloration and markings, whereas things from denser areas where the temperature may not get as warm and the sunlight's a lot harder to come by tend to be more heavily marked, intricately patterned, darker coloration and things like that. But in saying that, they always seem to manage to throw a spanner in the works and give me something that doesn't conform with that. I've caught hypo-looking carpets out of dense rainforests, and I've caught deep black, heavily patterned carpets out of open grassland and dry forest as well. So, and I think that what really makes them an interesting captive is the possibility of producing so much variation. They're just amazing animals with the colors and patterns that they're capable of producing.
Right. Yes, that's you bring up the whole thing is the farther or the I should say the colder climate. That's often why we think diamond pythons are have that dark black color because they need to absorb that sunlight. That's pretty interesting that you're seeing that same thing. What are your observations with the with the coastals in the field? Like, where are you finding them? Are you finding them in trees? Are you finding them, like, what are they doing when you come across them?
Eating people's pets.
Nice.
Oh no.
Yeah.
I guess you see that a lot, right?
Yeah, I do, and also just other forms of wildlife. I regularly get people ringing me up saying, "Can you come and rescue this possum from a carpet python?" And I sort of say,
"No, it's already gone."
Yeah, I say to them, I can't, for legal reasons, interfere with wildlife and it behaving naturally. I say, look, I'll come and take photos of it, and then I'll relocate the python when it's finished its meal, but I'm not going to interfere with nature in the way of I'm going to stop an animal surviving by
eating. Yeah.
And that
they,
sort of things.
Are they just eating whatever they come across? Are they meal-specific from... have you noticed any observations with that?
Oh, look, most of the animals I do encounter are probably moving around. It's a small sample size they're actually feeding, and that's obviously seasonal as well. Through the middle of winter, majority of the animals that I find have either been unearthed in some way from their overwinter site, whether it be in a wood pile, rock pile, a lot of the time in people's roof spaces and ceiling areas. And then obviously during the mating season, most of the animals I encounter are males moving to and from mating sites and overwinter sites and things like that. So, look, they are quite motile, really. They do move around quite a lot. And I have encountered the same animal numerous times over a particular season. And the most rewarding part of my job is being able to actually leave those animals to do their natural thing and move around. I don't really like relocating them great distances outside of their home range and unfamiliar territory and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, there was a question that Dave Kelly brought up, and he asked me about that topic because he said relocated king cobras, they have release stress, and when they're moved, they don't do, there's a high mortality rate. Do you see anything with any kind of stressors for carpets when you relocate them?
Unfortunately, I'm not able to follow them. I've always said that I would love to either afford the time and the money involved to do some sort of radio tracking study on the animals that I release to be able to get an understanding of what stresses they go through and what actually happens when they're relocated. I suppose that's one of the lucky things with being around them so much. I can try and sort of pick specific habitat for particular animals where I can guarantee their survival a lot greater, whereas if I just threw a snake in the car and drove out to the bush, let it go in the same spot every time, you probably find that it's going to come into competition with other pythons. It's not going to find a shelter site as readily, which puts it at risk to predators and things like that. It's one of those things that we really just don't know. I like to think that a lot of the animals that I relocate do survive, but in saying that, I can't follow them for long enough to know. So we try and relocate them as long away from people as possible, but sometimes
okay.
That's just not viable as well.
Now, do you try to find a similar habitat, or is, you know, is the environment similar? Is when you're when you're releasing them, is that what you're looking for? Or like, what's your, you know, what are you looking for as far as when you know the spot is right?
Look, ideally, if I don't have to relocate the animal at all, that's the best alternative. And I will always plead to the client that, look, it's a harmless carpet python. If you keep your pets inside, it's really just here doing you a favour by eating some pests like rodents and rats and mice and things like that. If I can have that animal stay where it is, that's always my first preference. The next preference... and we have to operate within regulations as well. There's a department that used to be referred to as National Parks and Wildlife Service. They've had quite a numerous name changes over the years, but they have regulations in place for the animal's welfare that we have to try and abide by. So obviously within that 500 metres to 1,000 metres of the capture site, is the next ideal release position. So if a client's property backs onto bushland, I'll try and relocate that animal onto that bushland. If that's not an alternative, then usually that 10 to 15 kilometre radius is still going to provide that animal with suitable habitat to be able to thrive and find food and not actually become competition to another snake. I mean, if I catch a carpet python in spot X and take it to spot Y and there's already five carpet pythons in spot Y, I may as well have just either left the snake where it was or put it out of its misery because it's going to be competition and be put out by pythons that already exist in that habitat. So, and obviously too, if I catch a carpet python in a dry grassland area, I'm not going to drive it to the middle of a rainforest and let it. We try and pick specific habitat for where those animals come from. So,
okay.
Has a carpet ever found its way back? Like, have you released it and then gotten a phone call from the same people saying that the thing came back?
Yes. Yeah. Look, it's a good way to drum up business, really, if they've got homing ability.
Yeah, point it back at the house and then go away, yeah.
I get customers. Look, occasionally, too, where people live, it's not the same snake. And, I mean, most people see a snake and they go, oh, it's a snake. So I try and document the markings to be able to tell whether it is the same animal or not. Only just this morning I had a phone call from a customer that I did a job for about 6 months ago, and I took that animal maybe 10 kilometres away from the residence where I removed it from, and they said to me today that it came back, and I said, can you tell them apart? Are you sure that it's not another carpet python, because they've provided suitable habitat and verging onto bushland and things like that? And he said, no, look, we can't tell. So I'm waiting on some photos to come through of that particular animal to see if I can match up the photos from the job 6 months ago to see if it is actually the same animal or not. Another instance, I had quite a large carpet python that I removed and relocated it about 15 or 20 kilometres away, and it took about 6 or 7 months, but it turned up on the property next to the original property where it was removed. So it really goes to show that they do have quite a homing ability, and I'm sure there's probably years of study there to a researcher to be able to find out how they actually navigate their territory to find their way back, either to suitable overwinter sites, suitable feeding sites, suitable mating grounds, and things like that. So, I mean, obviously, I try to allow them to come back. I mean, especially with a brown snake, I don't particularly want a brown snake travelling through suburbia to try and find its way back to the chook pen that it was captured from. But, I mean, with carpet pythons, a lot of time, too, you're probably not going to see it again. I can probably take it from the backyard to the front yard and let it go, and they'll never see it. But we try not to do that for the animal safety as well.
Right.
Right. But, you know, if you have a suitable habitat, they're going to just show up. So, yeah.
I think, I don't know if your volume on your radio is up there, Nathan, or because it seems like it's echoing. I don't know if you hear that.
Not really. I might have got a little bit excited and got too close to the microphone.
Okay.
Is that better?
yeah, there you go. Okay. I have a question about, and this wasn't in the outline that we had, but as we're talking, I think about it. What about nesting? You know, I've heard with Brettles that they return to the same nest, or there's thoughts that they do. Have you noticed anything as far as coastals with that? And what are they? What does their nest site look like? Have you come across it?
I haven't actually encountered a nest site in the field. I've encountered abandoned abandoned nest sites in certain areas, mainly in suburbia and farmland and things like that. I currently have a carpet python that was actually brought to me on a clutch of eggs, and it was in somebody's compost heap, so where they were putting grass clippings and vegetable matter to be able to add to their garden, and they were doing some gardening and actually unearthed this carpet python inside a mound of decaying vegetable matter, and they just picked the whole animal up and its egg mass and placed it into a basket and actually brought it to me. So that animal's still here with me now, and I was lucky that they provided enough of the substrate and everything like that with it. So I've basically just got it set up in a large tub on my quarantine room floor. So it's pretty much getting those ambient temperatures that it would be experiencing in the wild, and I've left that animal to do its natural thing. I feel that it's gone through the motions of being a parent. Who am I to take it away and artificially incubate those eggs? If I was to find an abandoned nest, then I would artificially incubate if there was no female around to maternally incubate. But when both the mother and the eggs are brought to me, and look, it's an interesting thing for me to document as well, witnessing her coming on and off the egg mass, doing her shivering to increase temperatures and things like that, soaking in water to transfer moisture and things like that to the eggs. But it's one of those things that I think that they're that selective on their sites that we just don't encounter them. There's been studies done on diamond pythons as far as where they have a preference for their egg-laying sites and nesting sites. And I mean, carpet pythons really are just a different coloured diamond python with a little bit different sort of habitat. That might upset a few people that like diamond pythons, but I mean, in the end, they're all just carpets, and there's some variation in their behaviour and ecology and things like that. But I tend to find that they do prefer moisture areas. Usually low-lying areas as well, but not particularly too low because of risk of inundation through flooding and heavy rains and things like that. The most common areas that I've found old nest sites is actually in people's hay sheds. In masses of bales of hay, it's quite thermally stable in there. The hay provides an insulation that enables the eggs to be able to survive even if they are abandoned.
That's interesting. Wow. You bring up diamond pythons, and how does that... we're still getting that echo. Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know if you hear that.
It's better.
Okay. There we go. We got it?
Go for it. All right.
What about the diamond coastal intergrade zone? What's your thoughts on that, and, you know, from your point of view?
Yeah, and I mean, as I've said numerous times to people, it really is just my opinion on that zone. I'm not a taxonomist. I'm not a qualified field herpetologist with years of study or anything like that. I did actually grow up close to that area. I was born in Sydney and grew up in Grafton on the mid-north coast of New South Wales, which is about 200, 300 kilometres from the centre of that intergrade zone, which is around the Kempsey Port Macquarie area. So I have experienced the habitat, the animals that occur in those areas. With DNA studies that have been performed on diamond pythons, carpet pythons and all of the other subspecies, they have been found to be quite closely related. My argument with that is, how can there be what most people's understanding of that intergrade zone is, it's a natural hybrid that's happening between coastal carpet pythons and diamond pythons. And technically that's not really the case. It's a gradual change in habitat where one subspecies or species, whichever way, whether you're a lumper or a splitter, tends to merge into one another. There's no line in the sand that coastal carpet pythons on one side, diamond pythons on the other, and anything that's on that line is a crossbreed between the two. I tend to find that they're more so habitat-specific adaptations and areas where there's a gradual change between a diamond python and a carpet python. Now, some people would argue the fact that an intergrade, or what's labelled particularly in the Australian hobby as a natural intergrade, is a diamond python cross a carpet python. I think in an evolutionary sense and a taxonomic sense, they're coastal carpet pythons that look like diamond pythons. There's big confusion in the hobby worldwide that you can get a diamond python and a coastal carpet python and breed it together to produce intergrades, and that's not the case. To label, and even to label a jungle cross a diamond as an intergrade, it actually annoys me a little bit, because it's not. It's mislabeling an animal. They're not an intergrade. Is a, as it sounds, it's an intergrade zone where subspecies and species overlap, and there's a gradual changeover between those species. You will find with certain areas where there is a large barrier that you're not getting those intergrade zones. I mean, Morelia bredelii, which used to be referred to as Morelia spilota bredelii, there's deserts surrounding those animals, so we don't get an intergrade zone there. When there's no clear barrier for the species to change, we're getting these intergrades, and I think intergrades occur right across the spilota group. There's the possibility of the inland or Murray Darling integrating with diamond pythons in southern New South Wales and northern Victoria and areas like that. There's intergrade zones between coastal carpet pythons and jungle carpet pythons. There's also intergrade zones where almost three species overlap between the variegata or diamond pythons, the Murray Darlings of northern Queensland from that Murray-Darling basin, and the jungle pythons of north Queensland. You've almost got this melding of three species, or three subspecies, that's giving rise to what people refer to as the Cape York pythons, which are really just a gradual changeover between those subspecies, because there's no real clear-cut barrier that stops that gradual change. Right. As I said, this is just my opinion. I probably regularly upset a lot of people with the opinion, but that's probably the joys with science in general.
That's fine. Go ahead and piss people off. It's okay.
Yeah, all science is just opinion, really.
Yep.
It's theories until proven as scientific fact. So, I mean, there's so much work that is able to be done on the entire complex, and until somebody really does that work. And then, look, once they do the work, you're probably going to get people that don't agree with it anyway and are going to be set in their mindset as to what they feel. And look, in the end, as long as we all love reptiles and we keep some locality-specific pure animals as well as some pretty coloured morphs and things like that, I don't really think it's something to lose sleep over, as far as, yeah, what animals are what and things like that. I think labelling the animals correctly is probably the most important point. And then people new to the hobby having an understanding of what the terminology actually means. And what subspecies occur where and things like that.
Interesting. What about, we hit on the inlands and the Cape Yorks, because that was my next question, so that's good. What about as far as back to in the field, have you ever seen male combat in the field? What's it like? How long does it last? How violent does it get? Is it, you know, are they biting each other? Or are they just kind of wrestling each other? What's your thoughts?
Oh, I tend to get sent more photos and video than actually viewing it myself. I find that by the time I get to most reports of male combat, it has actually ended. So, and I think it depends on how evenly matched the males are. If there's quite an extreme difference in their size and strength, then the combat's not going to last for very long. But when the animals are quite equal, it can last for some time, even upwards of an hour, and can get extremely violent. Many people have probably seen some of the photos that I've shared of wounds. Some people brought up possibly their prey combat wounds. So with trying to overpower a possum or a lace monitor or something like that. But a lot of these injuries tend to line up to observations in captivity. People stick two male carpet pythons together, they bite each other. Those wounds tend to match up with a lot of the wounds that I find on wild animals. So I don't think it causes death in majority of cases. And I think, one, that's a testament to how actual strong these animals are, that they can have exposed bone and have lacerations right down into the muscle tissue, and they still manage to heal and survive. And it also goes to show that it's still quite ritualised, the same as, I think, any animal combat. Male-male combat, they're not out to kill each other. They're out to prove their worth to be able to pass on those stronger genes. And killing the competitor is not really something that's necessary. I think that's where male combat in humans is probably a little bit extreme. It's dominate, kill, destroy. Whereas in the animal world, once everyone around you knows that you're the strongest and you have the most potent swimmers and everything like that, then that's all that's required. And you can go along then and spread your seed and know that the offspring are going to be as strong as you.
Right.
They don't go too far. They know when to stop.
Yeah, I don't really think that they're fighting to the death. I really think that cannibalism's probably not that prevalent in the wild, whereas in captivity, you're going to find that, the animals are more likely to actually, if they're hungry and there's no other food source around, and you're silly enough to keep two hungry carpet pythons together, they're possibly going to try and eat each other. Whereas if it was happening in the wild, there'd be no carpet pythons left, because every time a male fought another male, they'd eat each other, or every time a male and female come together for mating, they'd eat each other.
Right. Wow. observations with carpets and their arboreal nature? Are you finding the carpets in trees a lot, or is that just not as so much?
Even some of the largest carpet pythons that I've found, which are verging on that 8 and 9 feet in length and upwards of 6 to 8 kilos in weight, I still find them in people's roofs. See them up in trees and things like that. I mean, obviously you're not going to get an 8-foot carpet python climbing up a sapling or a small tree, but they still have capabilities. I think the common misconception is that once they get to a certain age or size, they become completely terrestrial, and it's not the case. They do have capabilities, even as a large adult, to be able to move around. I mean, obviously for food and to avoid predators, those smaller carpet pythons are going to remain off the ground to be able to prey on birds and small lizards and ambush their prey a lot easier, whereas you're probably finding that the larger carpet pythons don't find, a big enough prey item up in a tree, so they're sort of forced to come down onto the ground to find something more substantial food-wise, but they still have some amazing capabilities. I mean, as you guys probably know, a 6 or 8 foot carpet python still has the muscle strength to be able to make your hand go blue when it's constricting an arm. That muscle strength converted into climbing, they're still able to do it. So, yeah, I think in a captive sense, depending on how you personally manage your collection and the room that you have and everything like that, whether you choose to exercise your animals outside of their enclosure or you choose to provide them with climbing opportunities inside, I think it's only going to benefit the animal as far as increasing that muscle tone and also a behavioural enrichment type thing as well, to have something sitting on the ground all the time when they do have the possibility of climbing, you will find that they will climb if given the chance to.
Right.
How fast are they? I mean, little ones, I imagine, can break off and speed away from you. What about the big guys? They still give you a run for their money if they're trying to get away from you?
Look, not so much particularly on the ground in open areas. The larger ones, obviously, even a larger person is a bit slower than a smaller person, but at the same time, a big snake and a small snake, their strike speed is comparatively the same. The same as you get a big guy and a small guy, they probably can't run as fast as each other, but they can probably punch as fast as each other and that type of thing. So over those short distances, or if you're inside that strike range, an 8 foot carpet python can hit you just as fast as what a 6 inch carpet python can. Obviously the damage is going to be a little bit different there, but and they tend to still exhibit that same form of locomotion. Off the top of my head, I can't remember the three main forms of reptile locomotion, but they don't tend to move as you would imagine a big carpet python moving, like a big Burmese or a big anaconda. They still tend to move around as if they're a 4 foot carpet python. But
okay.
Dragging that weight around still does slow them up quite a bit.
Cool.
Okay. What about, well, before we do this, I guess what we do is I have a unit converter pulled up, because you'll probably say Celsius and I'll transfer it real quick to Fahrenheit. But what kind of temperatures are you finding where you find the carpets? And what does it differ from day to night? And what's the lowest that you've ever observed?
Oh, look, I've found animals in below 5 degrees Celsius. I mean, they're not particularly active, but I'm still encountering animals coming out and looking for warmth and something to drink and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I mean, look, their operational temperatures are quite amazing. The fact that they can be able to actually move around at such low temperatures, and then also high temperatures as well. I mean, we've had some days here recently where the temperatures exceeded 38, 39 degrees. Obviously, the animals aren't directly exposed to those temperatures. They're still able to find microhabitats and things like that where it's a lot cooler. But the temperature extremes that they can encounter in the wild is quite extreme.
Wow. So when you're saying, just so everybody knows, when you're saying 5 degrees Celsius, we're talking about 41 degrees Fahrenheit, and
yes.
38 degrees Celsius is about 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's some pretty extreme temperatures, but obviously they're in their microhabitats, and, you know, have you temped a carpet python, you know, when you found it? Have you taken a temperature of where it's at, what that temperature is?
Only just knowing the ambient temperatures. It's the sort of thing that now that you mention it, I probably will begin to to actually record those body temperatures of animals that I find.
Okay.
And look, I mean, even during winter, when it may be 0 degrees Celsius, which I think is 32 degrees Fahrenheit, in somebody's roof space, where the sun is still beaming down on some iron of their roof and the insulation and things like that, you probably find that the temperatures in that roof are still able to come up around that 20 degrees Celsius as well. So, I mean, look, if they weren't able to survive in the temperatures that they encounter, obviously there'd be no carpet pythons in the wild. So,
right.
They'd either be cooked or frozen.
Right.
Huh. Interesting.
I think when people are talking of reducing temperatures for seasonal breeding and cycling of their animals, even in the middle of winter, a carpet python still able to almost reach its preferred body temperature of 25 to 30 degrees Celsius through thermoregulation, whether it be coming out in the sun, finding a darkened area that's getting sunlight, so a dark-coloured rock out in the sun, even in the middle of winter, is still going to be a lot warmer than in the shade or in some water or something like that.
Interesting. Yeah, there's a lot of debate as far as temperatures and, you know, what do they need and et cetera, et cetera. Just off the topic real quick, and I guess this kind of can go back to breeding and such, but often people breed their carpet pythons, and the main thing that they follow is temperature. Do you feel, as observing them in the wild, do you feel that light cycles play a role in their breeding cycle?
Periods just as important as thermo periods. So having a seasonal variation in temperature, obviously that's going to trick the animal into thinking that it's a different season and to begin cycling for the coming breeding season. But I mean, clearly in the wild there's a shortening and lengthening of day length depending on the season. And I mean, that's something I try and emulate in my own collection, and I'm sure many other people do as well. I see a lot of arguments on the internet about the different methods for cycling animals and that type of thing. And I mean, really, whatever works for you works for you. But to really try and recreate the animal's natural habitat, that's obviously the ideal situation.
Right. As best that you can, yeah, absolutely.
That makes everything go smoother.
What do you think, have you ever come across any hatchlings in the wild?
I do. As you guys probably know, most of my experiences are with animals through my catch and release business.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, between my captive collection and business obligations there, I don't get as much time as I would like out in the field. Majority of the in situ type animals that I've found have varied in size, but everything eats a little carpet python, whether it's a big lizard or a bird or any of the other predators that are out there in the wild. So they do everything that they can to stay hidden, whereas a big python basically welcomes the challenge. If you think you can eat me, well, then be prepared to be eaten in the process type thing. So you tend to find a lot more of those larger carpet pythons. But in the removal business, I do encounter all different sizes and have found things almost to the point of still having an umbilical opening as if they're a week or two old from hatching, and finding some amazing sized meals in these small carpet pythons that you would think are under a month from hatching, and the lumps in their bellies are the size of an adult mouse.
Really?
Or a small bird. So, I mean, for people to sort of think that a 30 centimetre, a 12-inch hatchling carpet python needs to be fed a pinky mouse is not necessarily the case. Obviously, we don't need to push the limits, and food's not as scarce in captivity as it is in the wild, but it's amazing the size prey items that they can and will eat as juvenile snakes. And it's something that I've put into practice with my own small carpet python collection, is I tend to feed quite large food items for their first meals, and I tend to get quite a good feeding response out of those animals. And obviously the risk of diarrhea and things like that and dehydration associated with that's a lot less when you're feeding an animal that has some form of calcification of its bones and fur and fibre and things like that. You get stronger, more robust hatchlings and whatnot as well.
It makes sense, and it might be something to try with non-feeders by offering a larger meal.
Yeah, I mean, look, anything's worth a try. The same with scenting and things like that. I mean, over here, it was originally thought that hatchling carpet pythons needed to feed on small lizards before they were large enough to take prey items like rodents and birds. But I would probably argue that fact now that they're capable of taking an almost adult mouse as one of their first meals from hatching.
Wow.
But in saying that, you will get some of the younger ones and the smaller ones, whether they're the runt of the litter or animals from a twin egg or something like that, that they do require those smaller food items.
Cool.
Right. I have one more question from David Kelly. And it's, do you believe or have you found coastal carpets with bold black patterning? And I think what he's getting at is he thinks that what you're finding in the field is what would be a true coastal, and what we in the U.S. classify as a coastal would be actually an Atherton. What would you find in the Atherton locality carpet python? Are you finding anything with bold black patterning?
Yeah, well, I do find animals with quite a dark pattern. In saying that, though, there is still some, or what people refer to as tipping, so a reduction in colour of the scales and individual scales. I tend to think the most typical identifying colour and pattern feature of a coastal carpet python is that reduction in head coloration. You see some of the photos of some of these big old carpet pythons that I share, the head pattern's almost indiscernible. You can't actually tell what the pattern is on the top of the head, whereas jungles are typically known for quite a bold head pattern with heavy markings around the eye and things like that. It's one of the things, though, that even in the area where jungle pythons occur, and I'm by far not an expert on jungles in the field or in captivity, you do get coastal carpet pythons up that far north. Are these animals integrates or natural hybrids or intermediate forms where there's a gradual change between subspecies, or are they habitat adaptions of a particular subspecies to occupy that niche that best suits the survival of that colour or pattern? And, I mean, look, nothing compares to actually knowing where your animals come from. And, I mean, even in Australia, unless you collected the animals yourself, you really have to go on the honesty and integrity of the breeder that you're buying from as to the purity of the animals. So, I mean, look, I'm finding coastal carpet pythons that people have argued with me that it's an escaped jaguar or it's an escaped hypo mutation or caramel mutation. Some of these animals are coming from the middle of nowhere, so there's really no possibility of that happening. It just goes to show how variable they are.
Right. So anything really beyond that is just purely speculation.
Oh, it is. It is. I mean, I can probably find a carpet python that looks like a jungle, a coastal carpet python that looks like a jungle. You can probably find one that looks like a diamond. Are they diamonds? Yeah. Are they jungles? No, I don't think so. I think they're just individual variations. It's one of those things. A lot of people don't like the anecdote of comparing humans to animals, but just because a person looks like a particular locality or race, does that mean that they are from that particular locality or race? No, not necessarily so. And it goes to show with how variable carpet pythons are, that just because it looks like a particular locality doesn't necessarily mean that it is. But have faith in people. I mean, do your research and find someone who's recommended as being reputable for their locality-specific stock, and don't sort of question that. Obviously question it to some degree, but if you're happy with the response that you're getting with those animals, I mean, that's all you can really do. I can imagine it's exceptionally hard for you guys over there where there's no fresh imports coming in from this country, so any of the animals that you're dealing with, you basically have to take it on face value from where you're getting them from as to what they are.
If I can quote what Eugene Bissett said to us, unless you got a blood test, you ain't got shit. So
And then look, if you were to have a blood test, they're all carpet pythons with very, very similar DNA anyway. Are you going to even be able to tell?
Right. Well, so it's one of those things. This my computer's blowing up at me. Anyway, what type of carpet pythons or just reptiles in general do you work with personally in your personal collection?
The main component of my collection is actually children's pythons, particularly Antaresia childrenae. The collection consists of over 100 animals, and a good 60 to 70% of those are Antaresia childrenae, mainly holdback animals, and future breeding stock, and adult animals. The two biggest interests for me are the genus Liasis, so water pythons, olive pythons, hopefully one day white-lipped pythons, which are becoming available in the Australian hobby.
Wow, really?
Yeah, there's a few popping up. Look, there's speculation as to whether they've ever occurred on mainland Australia, but they have been recorded from islands in the Torres Strait, which are Australian territories, and when some license systems in certain states in Australia were implemented, there was animals that were held in those collections that were allowed in the license system and recognised as Australian white-lipped pythons. And obviously through whatever means these new animals have come into the hobby, there is going to be the possibility in the next few years to be able to keep them. And, I mean, to be honest, white-lips actually excite me more than Oompelli. I mean, obviously, both are quite interesting animals, and Oompelli's being a completely endemic animal to Australia. With my personal interest in that particular genus, I'm probably looking at investing in white lips before I invest in Oompelli's. I mean, ideally, I'd love to have both, but I've sort of got to go with where my heart takes me as well as where the bank balance takes me.
I can completely agree with you. Because then, Eric, did you hear that? White lips are cooler than Oompelli. Done. And this guy's from Australia.
Without carpet python guys, I think carpet python guys tend to say that they're the obscure collection type people when compared to ball pythons, but really Liasis guys are just way cooler.
I'll agree to that one too. See, I'm liking what you are putting down. This is great. So, some people here gave up their Liasis to the other guy. So, Anyway.
And look, I keep a small collection of lizards and turtles and things like that as well. I regularly get just members of the public asking me how many pet reptiles do I have, and I say I have about 3 or 4. And I mean, when I refer to a pet, I refer to something that you sit down and watch television with, and you have a bit of a pat and you interact with. If they ask me how many animals do I have in my collection as far as breeding goes, then I'll say, oh well, look, there's over 100 reptiles in the collection there. So I've got a pet lace monitor that we're working on target training and things like that, because the intelligence of these animals is amazing, and the zoo background that I come from and the animal behaviour study that I've done just personally through my own personal research has really intrigued me as to the capabilities of these animals as being trainable. I mean, obviously I'm not going to get him to do tricks and jump through a hoop, and I'm not going to ride on his back like a killer whale or anything like that, but to make an animal like that more manageable, it's really exciting. And then things like pink-tongued skinks, blue-tongued skinks, even a lot of the Agernia groups, like Cunningham skinks and things like that, I keep a few of. And look, as controversial as it may be worldwide, it's not particularly an Australian controversy or an American one or anything else, but I really love hybrids. And when I talk hybrids, I don't mean a jungle cross a coastal or a coastal cross a diamond. I'm talking carpondros, jagapondros. I mean, we're not allowed to keep exotics here, but things like bat eaters, all possibilities. It's just unfortunate that many states in Australia deem that as illegal, so we're not able to produce these animals. But hopefully in the future, I've aspirations of producing a scrubby cross olive python and green tree python, cross spotted python and things like that as well. So, and I mean, in the end, if the animal's cared for correctly and happy and healthy and everything like that, who's to say and judge what shouldn't be kept? Some people don't like albinos. Some people don't like jags. Some people don't even like seeing snakes in cages. I mean, in the end, if it's got a quality of life and it's being cared for and you give that animal the love and respect that it deserves, who's to sort of judge who isn't right and wrong in the animals that they produce and keep and everything like that?
Right. To each his own.
Yeah.
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 So have you ever observed anything in the wild that would make you adjust how you keep or breed your animals in captivity? Like, did you notice something going on with a carpet out in the bush that you brought home?
It's one of the things that when I first started keeping it at a very young age and was passed on from my father and a few other herpers that taught me a lot of my basic knowledge, was try and recreate the animal's natural environment as much as possible, and you'll have success. I mean, obviously, if you got a turtle and kept it in a tub with some aspen bedding, it's not going to survive very well. We recreate a turtle's environment by having water and a basking site and everything like that. It goes for all reptiles. If you can recreate every single piece of its natural behavior and habitat and things like that, you're obviously going to have a lot more success. I mean, whatever's viable for you as well. I mean, look, most of my adult carpet pythons are housed in 3-foot by 2-foot by 2-foot enclosures with a water bowl and a hide, occasionally a perch, a warm side and a cool. The animals do okay in that, but I think if I was to have some diamond pythons outside that were getting a natural photo period and naturally being able to thermoregulate and things like that, I would probably argue that they're better animals than an animal kept indoors. As far as the quality goes, there's probably not much of a difference, but quality and happiness, if we can link those together, then obviously you're going to produce an overall higher standard of animal compared to something else? I mean, look, coming back to that question of what have I changed, not being scared about letting them get cold is probably something that I think a lot of people go, oh, they're from Australia, they must constantly require 30 degrees all of the time. And then people are wondering why they're not breeding their animals when they give them a constant temperature year-round. Obviously, those animals still need a basking site even through winter. As I said in one of the questions, that a wild carpet python in the middle of winter is still almost able to obtain its preferred body temperature of 25 to 30 degrees. In captivity, it's basically the same. Don't be scared about them getting too cold, as long as they're still able to, particularly during the day, obtain a preferred body temperature, even if it's just for a couple of hours every day.
Cool. So you don't even need to be concerned too much about that. So about with the temperature shift, what is your approach to breeding your pythons?
Look, most of my animals are maintained with a constant basking temperature, and that doesn't really alternate year-round. Everybody does things differently, from heating the whole room and just cycling photo period to doing nighttime drops and daytime drops and no heating at night and all of these different variations. And I mean, it comes down to whatever works for your animals. I think it's more important than what actually works for yourself. Try and keep your animals happy, not you just can't afford a heat bulb in every cage or something like that, then you probably shouldn't have the collection that you have. But, I mean, if heating an entire room works for you, then, and if your animals are happy, then go with that. My animals during winter, obviously the cool side, which if females and males that are wanting to cycle, if they want to achieve temperatures of 10 or 15 degrees Celsius, then I allow them to do that. But at the same time, if they want to achieve their preferred body temperature of 30 to 32 degrees Celsius, I give them that option as well. But I do cycle that photo period. So during winter, I'm down to maybe 8 to 10 hours of daylight, whereas during summer, I can give in excess of 12 hours of daylight. And then obviously the cool side during summer, my reptile room, which is just a spare room in my apartment, it still thermally cycles between seasons. Those 40 degree days that we had recently, the warm side and the cool side in my enclosures was identical. It was all 34 degrees Celsius. Obviously during winter, heating kicks in and everything like that, and the animals are able to get 32, 33 if they want, but then at the same time I find when females are wanting to cycle themselves, they'll be right up the cool end of the tubs, wrapped around the water bowl, sitting at about 8 degrees Celsius, and they're fine.
Cool. So they actually try to take care of themselves there. If the temperatures aren't what they need to be, they'll actually get into the water bowl.
Yeah, definitely. And then sometimes I'll look at that and go, right, well, maybe I should switch the heat off for a couple of hours of a night time if that particular rack is trying to achieve a cooler temperature. I'll sort of read those animals and go, yeah, well, maybe they do want to get a little bit cooler. But at the same time, when the daylights come on, I still give them what they would normally be able to achieve in a daylit area in the wild, so they're able to still get up close to that preferred body temperature and things like that. I mean, the studies that are done on wild diamond pythons, a black snake on a black rock in full sun, even at 0 degrees Celsius air temperature, is still probably able to achieve close to 30 degrees Celsius as a body temperature. So I think to go and stick your diamond pythons in a fridge, as you would a colubrid, is probably not going to work. You're going to end up with RI and scale rot and things like that. But
right.
to give them cool temperature and also access to that basking site, the animals can choose. And look, as I said, they wouldn't survive in the wild if they weren't able to choose those temperatures and things like that. And if we provide them with that in captivity, then you're probably going to have happier, healthy animals and possibly better breeding success. I'm sure there's plenty of people out there that wish that you could just get two snakes and rub them together and make babies.
And those people keep bull-ins. I mean, but awesome. So that's one of the things that people have been kind of dancing around. I know when I started breeding, it was drop your temps to, you know, 70-something, and then it was, you know, keep your basking temps up, and then it was drop the ambient temps. So it's one of those things that's forever changing, but I think it's with keeping the basking site but dropping the ambient to allow them to get cool but with the option of warming themselves is kind of where we're all settling. About your pictures now, you posted a pic of a Darwin python a while back, and it has a stripe, and you called it a ghost Darwin. Can you give us any story on that guy? Because he looked awesome. I'm pretty sure people here in the States were, like, throwing money at the screen, so that, hoping that it would come to them. So,
I don't know much about the animal. I mean, I was close to the end of high school when I first saw pictures of those animals. They originally were produced by some breeders in North Queensland by the name of Nick and Rex Stock, and they were quite open and honest with the animals they were producing and everything like that, coming from pure Darwin Morelius bloata variegata stock. The original founder animal, I think, appeared just at random. There was breeding trials in place. I've done a little bit of research since just picking that photo, and they had a belief that it was an incomplete or codominant trait.
Wow.
There was more trials that were required. Look, that original animal probably surfaced almost a decade ago now. And the project was split up and sold off to numerous different people. And the main reason why I posted that photo was to try and find out how the line's going. And no one sort of put their hand up and said, oh, look, I've got 100 of them, or I've got 2 of them, or anything like that. So I think
about the originals or anything like that.
I think it's possibly one of those projects that has either died out through lack of interest, or the people who are working on it have produced something super spectacular and don't want to release that information until they've fixed enough to be able to maintain a market stability for them, or anything in between. Look, for all we know, they all could have swum somewhere else, to Indonesia or Europe or Africa or America. No, we really don't know, and until someone sort of comes up with showing off photos or admitting to working on that line. And look, amazing looking animals, and I mean, as much as I love mutations and hybrids and everything like that, it would have been interesting to see where that project would have gone without the introduction of JAGs and things like that into Australia. So I think that's probably more so what's happened, is there's a lot more guaranteed results from known fixed mutations getting around, that majority of the people don't want to put the legwork into actually producing something super exciting and interesting when they can buy an animal, breed it to another animal, and get results in 3 years instead of taking 10 or 15 years to produce those same results. Look, hopefully it's still out there. There's a lot of information on the Australian Pythons and Snakes forum, so if people wanting to go and do a bit of a search on there, you'll find a lot of photos and be able to contact people through their posts and things like that, where they've either made comments or the original breeders and things like that. I mean, I don't want to comment too much on the animals because they're not mine. I really don't have never spoken to the original breeders or anything like that. So it's one of those things that I've had the photo for some time and was offered some outcross animals many years ago from that line, but of no real particular interest to me. I sort of kept the photo and went through some photos recently and saw it and went, oh, I'm sure people on the worldwide internet would love to see these pics, and hopefully I can find out some more info on them. Nothing's come to light yet, so it'll be interesting to see whether they do pop up. But at the same time, it's interesting to see what's popping up in Australia and overseas as far as different colours and pattern mutations and things like that. And even some of the pure lines are mind-blowing as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a gorgeous animal, and you hate to think that it just went by the wayside just because the morphs hit the market. I mean, it would. That's the thing is that you can breed as many morphs as you want, but you know, don't let the cool things go by the wayside just because it's a normal. I mean, that's gorgeous. I would love to have that thing, and you know, I hope they turn up. I hope somebody all of a sudden just pops up out of nowhere and goes, I got all of them, and you know,
yep.
Now we got something new to check out with the whole Darwins. I mean, that'd be something cool to look at. So, yeah,
they are amazing animals, and I tried to find photos of the hatchlings. I'm hoping there's someone out there listening that's actually got some photos of them as hatchlings. I can't describe them or compare them to anything else. It's really, really unusual. I mean, as most people know, that Darwin carpet pythons are quite an orange coloration upon hatchling. And then as they grow, they go through somewhat of a color change and things like that. These animals were mind-blowingly spectacular. And the website that they were on, which was designerscales.com.au, just doesn't exist anymore. So I haven't been able to find the photos of those hatchlings. The photos that did exist would rival any current ball python mutation or any other python mutation for that matter. And then they've actually turned into a result of what the name was coined as a ghost Darwin carpet python. So, yeah, hopefully they're out there still. It might even be the sort of thing that the person's just got them all and doesn't really have an interest in being in the scene and in the marketplace and everything like that, so they're happy keeping the animals and trading amongst friends and everything like that, which happens in the hobby. And as long as they still exist, I think that's probably the main thing. I'm sure everybody would love one, but
yeah,
as long as they're still being kept.
As long as they're still out there.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely, very cool. So with your field experience with carpet pythons, is there any tip you could give to the python keepers? What would it be? What would be the main tip that you could give to anybody keeping carpet pythons from what you've seen in the wild?
I'd probably say keep a close eye on a weather map in Australia and do some research on the natural weather patterns and temperature cycles and photo periods and everything like that. I mean, you hear talk of green tree python and Boland's python breeders waiting for storms to come through for a drop in barometric pressure to introduce animals and things like that. Obviously, those weather patterns happen worldwide. It doesn't necessarily mean you need to bring all your carpet pythons to Australia so they experience the weather patterns over here so you can breed them. But, yeah, I'd probably say just do a lot of research on not so much the natural habitat, because, I mean, that's basically just a looks thing. But as far as the climate goes and weather pattern and things like that and photo period, that's really going to give you a leg up in being able to care for those animals optimally as if they would be in the wild. which is then going to cycle those animals better for any future breeding and things like that. But in the end, research, and try and find somebody who's had success that you can either try and emulate or learn from and things like that. I mean, obviously going down to the local pet shop where they buy everything from a supplier, you may not get the right information, whereas if you search and find a breeder that's got 10 or 20 years of consistent production of carpet pythons, send them a message. And I mean, as long as you're genuine in your questions, I think most breeders don't have a problem with sharing information when it comes to trying to educate people so the animals are cared for better and everyone has more success.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, it's one of those things that I can't agree more with the light cycle and the weather. That's what we're looking at. We're trying to breed the white lips up here, and that's something we're definitely taking good care at looking at, and even just the natural setup, because, you know, our white lips, apparently in the wild, they breed undercover and in burrows, so trying to emulate what you can find in the wild is, I think, the best shot you got.
The wild knows best is pretty much what it comes down to. There's no amount of manipulation and captive environments and things like that is going to be as good as Mother Nature. Obviously, if they need to be kept in a box and have all of these masses of sciences behind cycling them for breeding and everything like that, you wouldn't find them in the wild. There's obviously something out there that Mother Nature does that reptiles in general, snakes and everything else included, they're keyed in and in tune to that environment so much that to emulate that as much as possible is only basically going to guarantee you more success.
Right. Now, the reptile hobby in Australia is much different than the reptile hobby in the United States. What is it like, and do you think that it's actually growing to a certain point?
It's probably a hard question there in the sense of what do we define growth? Do we define it as economically stable growth? Is it going to maintain these breeders as businesses and things like that, or is it a growth in the term of new mutations and different lines and that type of thing? Look, a lot of Australians tend to argue that people want the Australian hobby to go in the direction of another overseas hobby, whether it be Europe, America, any of the other countries or continents that keep reptiles as well. In the end, I think it's human nature to want something attractive. It's not going to matter what country you're from or what animals you're working with. You're going to get those people that they don't want a brown carpet python. They want something with squiggly lines or red eyes or that's black and yellow or white and orange or anything like that. And you're not going to stop, really. The Australian hobby is growing. There's some amazing things happening. I mean, as I've mentioned, the Owen Pelly Python project with Gavin Bedford coming to fruition over the next few years. And then also the mutation market. In a conversation with Eric recently, I made the comment that we're probably pretty close to overtaking the overseas market as far as the production of Jaguar pythons in Australia. Some of the Jags we're producing over here really crap all over the stuff that you guys have got. But then at the same time, the challenge has been laid down, fellas. And, I'm sure the guys out there with gamma stuff and things like that are probably going, oh, yeah, well, we'll show you. But
we'll show you after a 24-hour plane ride. Now. What are they going to do?
I could probably pull a wild carpet python out of the scrub that looks better than a gamma jag sometimes.
Oh, Jesus. Gauntlet has been dropped. Okay.
And then look, the mutation market and the lines that some people are working on right across the board. Some of the black-headed mutations that are being worked on in Australia are amazing. Some of the antaresia morphs and localities that people are working on are mind-blowing as well. Obviously, the variation that we have here is second to none. You look at the bull python market, and most of those animals originate from wild stock.
Right.
Obviously, wild stock from a country, but they still, all of these mutations had, most of them had a founding father or something like that in their native land. So it goes to show in Australia that really the sky's the limit for what we're capable of producing. And I just hope that people tend to not only produce these amazing, pretty coloured snakes, but also from a conservation sense. Look, animals are never going to be released into the wild, because if they're extinct in the wild, it probably means there's no habitat. So if there's no habitat, there's no point in releasing them. But to have an example of that wild type still in captivity is only going to benefit future generations. I'm sure if pandas couldn't exist in the wild, people wouldn't go, well, let's get rid of them from zoos because they're not pretty enough or something like that. People aren't going to complain about still looking at a panda in a zoo. It's the same as a plain old brown carpet python. They may not be worth a lot of money. They may not be the apple in everybody's eye, but they're still worthwhile keeping.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. So now we get to the hard questions. And the hard question is, if you could work with any type of Morelia with no limitations, what would it be?
Look, it'd have to be probably what every snake keeper likes, and it'd have to be Bolani, really.
okay.
And look, I probably not only speaking for a large portion of the Australian hobby, but a large portion of the world hobby. I mean, who doesn't love them? If you don't love them, someone must have dropped you on your head when you were a child, because there's definitely something awe-inspiring about them. And look, as far as Morelia, without going into taxonomic shake-ups and everything like that, scrubbies, the different scrubby localities and everything like that, and species of scrub python are quite amazing in their own right as well. Look, my personal opinion, I don't think that green tree pythons and rough scales should be in Morelia. They're not carpet pythons. I mean, look, technically scrub pythons, you really look at them and you look at a carpet python and they're not Morelia. I mean, Morelia is probably particularly a sole carpet python genus, but as I said, I'm not a taxonomist. It's basically just my opinion and everything like that. Mm-hmm. I love green tree pythons. I love rough scale pythons. As far as what's classed as Morelia now, scrub python localities and species and subspecies, and then obviously Morelia are probably the two that really interest me in an exotic sense. And then obviously Oompelli are probably up there, very, very high up there for everybody in the world. But myself included, whether you think of them as just a giant children's python or a brown scrub python or whatever, they're still amazing animals. So the opportunity to keep those in coming years is going to be something that I'm sure a lot of people are going to strive towards. So look, the grass is always greener, isn't it, though?
Once you get the Oompelli, we're all going to want dragon rat snakes or whatever the new rare thing is now. So
And I mean, once we're able to keep them and all of our coastal carpet pythons and everything like that, I'm sure most people with a carpet python that most people in the States drool over, everybody would probably swap it for a $700 pied ball python. And I mean, as much as the carpet guys tend to rag on the ball guys, they're still pretty snakes. No one can argue, because they'd sit there and do nothing and they're fat with short heads and no tails, all that sort of stuff. They're still pretty. You wouldn't sort of kick them out of bed for eating toast in there or anything like that. You can still crease it. It's nice looking. So.
Well, that brings us to the next question of what it, now, same question, but any reptile that is not in the genus Morelia?
All of them. Most.
All of them? All right.
Yeah. Come on, guys. Anyone who loves reptiles, you can't pick a favorite. I mean, when it's in your blood and it's in your heart, you can't. Look, I'd love to have a pied ball and a super tiger, or a tick, or a berm, or a green iguana, but at the same time, I'd love to have dragon snakes, flying snakes, jaguars, king cobras, Mangshan's vipers, Gaboon vipers. Look, I could rant on for another 2 hours about what I want to keep that's not native. And then after that, I can probably rant for another 2 hours about what's native that I want to keep. Things like Boyd's forest dragons, some of the different localities of blue tongues, some of the smaller skinks, some of the geckos like granite belt thick tails and things like that, giant cave geckos, some of the elapids that are in Australia like mulgars, the king browns. There's a plethora of animals out there that I'm sure everyone would love to keep, but what do you do there? Do you end up living as a hobo surrounded by snakes, or do you try and sort of have a collection that's manageable and everything like that? So I'm sure if everyone could, they'd spend every last dollar that they earned on every single animal that they wanted to keep, but then I'm sure our significant others would really love that, wouldn't they? We're all living in a car surrounded by snakes. Most of them don't even like living in a house surrounded by snakes. So.
Yeah, that's the truth.
Can't be hobos and cars full of snakes. Much as we want
to
be.
For everyone to put to their wives tonight, wives and girlfriends and partners, just ask them the question, what would you rather? A house full of snakes, or we live in a car full of snakes? Because if you don't sort of nurture my hobby and come along for the ride, that's where it's going to go. Credit to everybody's partners. I mean, a shout out to my partner for being so supportive and everything like that and accepting of it. And I'm sure everybody out there, whether our partners have an interest in reptiles or not, they really are the supporting factor to a lot of people out there to just have that person in the background that sort of goes, oh, he's going to talk about reptiles again, isn't he? But we all love each other and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's the sort of thing to say thank you to them because it's the sort of thing to – we can love reptiles all we want, but as much as we might like to think they keep us warm on a cold winter's night, nothing does as much as as another human, so...
Yeah.
That is a good point.
That's a valid point. Even if the significant others themselves are into reptiles, it's a very good point. So... Yeah.
Well, see, I told you, Nathan, that 2 hours would go in a
fly
flash.
By.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, look, definitely, so. I could go for another two.
I guess what we'll do is before we jump out, we want to make sure we get your information out there. A couple things that I want to make sure that people follow as far as your Facebook page and stuff is I see you're posting up pictures, like you said earlier, of things that you're encountering in the wild, relocations that you're doing. I think you have something called Terrarium Tuesday or something like that, where you show these crazy...
Yeah.
Setups and stuff, but go ahead, give your information out.
Yeah, look, Google's a wonderful thing for being able to find cool photos. I mean, I'd love to take credit for them being all in my collection, but it's just not the case. But to be able to share those things with everybody, I've coined the term sharing the herp love, and really that's what it's about. Whether you like morphs, pure snakes, lizards, frogs, turtles, conservation, anything like that. It's a passion that we all have, and if I can share that passion with one person, that makes me happy. So, I mean, come along to the Facebook page and obviously give us a like and a follow and everything like that, and hopefully I won't disappoint with all of the pictures and information. And look, don't be scared. I think the only stupid question is the one that's not asked. If you have a question of myself, and, I mean, even of you guys, and anyone out there that we sort of view as having some form of experience, is, yeah, put your hand up and ask a question. You're not going to learn unless you ask. So thanks for the opportunity here, and hopefully we can gain a few more followers on the Chimera Productions Facebook page and sort of make my head swell a little bit bigger and everything like that in the process. We all love a swelled head, but at the same time, it's about sharing reptiles. Look, I love them, you love them, everybody should love them. I'm sure if we had our way that even the people that hate snakes would love them, but yeah. I mean,
yeah.
We can just change the mindset of a couple of people every time, then that's obviously going to be a benefit to us and the animals and the hobby and everything like that in general. So,
definitely.
Yeah. So, good stuff. All right. You know, we appreciate you taking some time and with us and talking with us. And, hey, anytime you want to talk snakes, let me know and we'll bring you back on. I think... very informative, very great show, and I appreciate you spending some time with us.
Yeah,
no, look,
definitely.
I appreciate it as well. I mean, you guys sort of came out and basically headhunted me as your first show for 2014, so I'm forever grateful on that. I mean, look, extend an offer to anyone who wants to come over to Australia and go and look for snakes. I can't guarantee you that we'll find any, but we'll see some awesome countryside along the way. Look us up on Facebook, and if you're ever over for a visit, I love any excuse to get out in the field, so if I can get out in the field with someone who shares the passion instead of by myself, then that's always going to be an exciting thing as well. So,
me and Owen might take you up on that.
Definitely. Bring the whole family, and we can dump them beside the pool and go looking.
Yep. Yep, that's it. It's a carpet. It's a Morelia Python radio-sponsored trip to Australia. Done.
Well, we might even have to try and organize a carpet fest down under.
There you go.
No. Yes.
Oh, wow. How cool would that be?
Worldwide, dude, yes.
Well, you've got your International Arboreal Symposium, so why can't we have an International Carpet Symposium in the country where carpets are from? Look, it's probably the only place where they originate from. I mean, I'm sure everyone would love to go to Irigaray or PNG to see carpets, but you're only going to see one part there, and look, they all look like Darwin's anyway, so you may as well come down to Australia and see all the variety in one.
That's right. I'm down.
Awesome. I'm so right. For this.
Awesome. Thanks for that, guys. I've got a bunch of missed calls on my phone now, so I'm going to go and catch some snakes and hopefully keep you guys up to date on it on the Facebook page.
All right.
Please do.
Thanks for coming on, Nathan.
No, that's all right. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. See you.
Have a good day.
All right. You too. Bye.
Bye. What a cool episode.
That was sweet.
I really like that. Nathan is a good guy. I could just tell from like watching his post on Facebook just how cool it would be to talk to him about what he's coming across in the wild. So awesome.
How cool would it be to go with him on like a call though?
Oh my God! Come on, that'd be nuts.
You know
what I mean?
Insane.
Like, he would probably like, we were talking the night before on the phone, and when we're talking, you know, he was saying about how to him, you know, finding, like a blue tongue skink or a carpet python was kind of like, you know, you kind of take it for granted, so to speak. And like, if you found like, a rattlesnake or something up here, we would be like, or a corn snake or something, we'd be like,
in the sports world, you do what's called a home at home. You know, you go play at their stadium, and then they come to play at your stadium. We should go to Australia and do a bunch of herping, and then we should bring those guys here and do a bunch of crap like around rattlesnake territory and crap like that. Like, find the cool shit that lives here, because then we'll have a more of appreciation for the, you know, the corn snake or a ringneck or something like that. It's
right.
Just cool. So.
He was even saying about the non-reptile stuff, like, you know, for us, oh, I don't know about you. Well, yeah, you probably would see this too, but deer, you know, coming across deer, that's like normal to us, you know. We kind of
It's like kangaroos to them. They're like, they're freaking everywhere.
Yeah. No, can you imagine driving down the road, seeing a kangaroo on the side of the road? You'd be like, what the hell? You know, oh, my God.
They're like, holy crap, a kangaroo. And they're like, Jesus Christ. I'd be like, you driving down the road going, oh, my God, it's a deer.
So yeah, it's just kind of weird how it's all relative, but cool stuff nonetheless. Let's see. I guess we'll just do our shout outs and we'll be done. You know, I did a little digging. To try to come up with, you know how we always do an outro song, and tonight because people were talking about, you know, playing guitar at Carpet Fest and whatnot, but the closing song will be a jam that I did a while back.
So everyone should just turn off now.
Yeah, it was just three piece band, just totally improvised in the studio. I thought it was cool, so we'll play it at the end. But check it out. But anyway, I digress. MoreliaPythons.com, the forum. Go over there and give it some love. And I got to admit, the past couple weeks that we've been off, I really haven't. I very rarely was on Facebook, and really have fallen out of the loop, so to speak, as far as the reptile world. I'm back in the swing of things, and should be cool for 2014. I wanted to give a shout out to our peeps, Buddy Buscemi and Bill Segal.
You have peeps now?
Yeah. I know. When my Philly came out, what the heck?
Yeah, that was horrible. I'll overlook it.
Yeah.
Continue.
Thank God it's in the closing part of the show that I said. anyway. Those guys have decided to start a Green Tree Python Keeper radio.
Started here? My God. Then it was Corrales, and now it's like we've got like two sister shows. Now it's great. I love it. I already told them. I said, I'll come on as a guest, and I guess Eric can come too. So...
Yeah.
You know.
So, you know what? I couldn't think of two better guys to do that kind of show, because both of them very passionate about chondros and green tree pythons, and very nice guys. And
I've said from the get-go, you know, people are like, why don't you get chondros? I'm like, there's only one person I'll buy chondros from, and, you know, when I'm ready, I'm going to give Buddy a call, and that's where we're going to go. So.
Yeah.
Anybody else who comes at me with chondros who isn't Buddy Buscemi, sorry, ain't gonna happen. So
I hold those guys in the utmost respect that I have for them and their knowledge of chondros, and I think of Buddy at Carpet Fest, and you know, he's coming as a chondro breeder and keeper breeder. Just talking to the carpet people about chondros, and you know, don't be afraid of them, and et cetera, et cetera. So they're not going to do a weekly show. I think it's going to be maybe quarterly or
something. Cool.
to the effect, but it's going to be cool nonetheless. I know their first show is on the 22nd. It's at 9:30 p.m., and they have, what's her name, Dr. Heather Bowles, I think. And they're going to talk about medical issues in chondros, which is one of the, I guess what's one of the things that people are most afraid about when it comes to chondro keeping. And, you know,
awesome.
I'm sure she'll bring a lot to the table, and it's cool stuff. So whereas we skim on the surface of chondros but go into depth with carpets, those guys will be going into depth with chondros like you won't believe. So look forward
there
to...
There is literally a radio show for everything cool now.
yeah, no, the next is going to be Bull and I Radio, but I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, next I'll be starting the White Lip Radio with my co-host, you. So,
there
you know,
you go.
This way it's just, yeah, it's the same damn shit. But, you know, it's whatever. So
be looking forward to that. Let's see, talked about the forum, talked about that carpet row page. Howard was talking
mm-hmm.
about it. He started that earlier. I put a link over on the Morelia Python Facebook page. But, yeah, be sure to go check that out because Tinley Park's coming up March.
Yes.
See the carpet guys. I won't be at the March show, I don't think. I might be able to see it.
I don't think I will either.
But definitely.
I'm going to try, but. You know.
The October one is it's going to be, hopefully if I have a good season, I'll be out at the October one. With some cool carpets for people.
Mm-hmm.
But cool stuff nonetheless. What else do I got? For all things Morelia, make sure you check out MoreliaPythonRadio.com. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, guests you'd like to hear, topics, et cetera, be sure to check out, or you can email us at info@MoreliaPythonRadio.com. I want to give a shout-out to our good friend Nick Mutton. He did a cool show with Vin Russo talking about boas. I thought it
nice.
Was really good over on Herp Nation Radio. I see a lot of similarities between the boa complex and, you know, boa constrictors and carpet pythons. So it's cool to hear those guys talk. one of the cool things that he said on the show, he actually stole it from Vin Russo, but I think I might steal it from Nick. It's not the, they were talking about the paint jobs of, snakes and such. And, basically he said, you know, they equated it to cars, and he's mm-hmm. like, imagine just looking at the paint job of a car, as opposed to people wanting to find out how it runs. And, you know,
right, looking under the hood and stuff.
It seems like in the reptile world today, that people are just focused on the paint job of the car and not what makes
right.
it run. So, you know, or the paint job of the snake and not what makes it, tick. But,
yeah, yeah.
So, so there's that. And then, I guess for me, check out ebmorelia.com. Now that my vacation from the reptile world is over, I'll be updating that more often. So check over there on the breeding diary for updates on the pairings for 2014. And that's all I got. Go ahead, Owen. Take us out.
All right, what we got is you can go to rogue-reptiles.com, check out all the cool stuff we got going on at Rogue. New baby pictures are coming up, as well as show announcements for the 2014 year. You can go to rogue-reptiles@facebook.com. Check us out there. Give us a like. You can also go to rogue_reptiles@Twitter, where we have some deals going on, as well as other stuff we got shooting around at Rogue. We will not be vending the Oaks Reptile Show this Sunday in Oaks, Pennsylvania, but I believe we will be in attendance, so if you want to order a baby, it can be delivered there. You can save off of shipping, and you don't have to worry about the cold. That's all I got. Actually, I do have one more thing, wishing a happy birthday to my girlfriend, Anna Maria Moso. There you go. Have to do that.
Oh, wow.
Otherwise, I'm in trouble. Yeah.
Happy birthday.
Yep.
Oh, wait, her birthday's today? Her birthday's
yes.
today?
Yes. Birthday's oh. today.
Wow, that's dedication for you people. Wow.
Hey, I got weekend plans. It's okay. It's all right.
Okay.
I'll make up for it then. Okay.
Good. Good job.
The hell are we doing discussing this on the air? Anyway, without any further ado, thanks for coming back and listening to us for the 2014 year. It's good to be back, and we'll see you all next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.